I think this time of the year, a few months into the school year, is when negative behaviors can become really challenging and overwhelming. Our students know what boundaries to push. We maybe have slid into some not so great habits or strategies that aren't working. And as an educator, as a clinician, we feel tired. We feel burnt out. We've tried all these things that haven't worked, and we're still struggling with disruptive problem behavior in the classroom. Well, that's exactly what I'm going to talk about at my webinar in a few weeks on November 7th. I'm going to share one of my favorite webinars, Defiance and De-escalation. And in this workshop, I'm going to share strategies and essential actionable tips that you can do in your classroom to reduce challenging behaviors. This webinar is for any educator that is working with any child that's struggling in the classroom, with or without a diagnosis, all ages. We're going to talk about how to safely de-escalate. We're going to talk about how to set boundaries, and we're going to talk about how to deal with those defiant situations. So I want to see you live on November 7th. I'll be live at 3 p.m. or 7 p.m. Central. See you there.
Hi, I'm Sasha Long, special ed teacher and board certified behavior analyst. Welcome to the Autism Helper Podcast. I'm here to explore different strategies to improve the lives of individuals with autism.
Welcome back to the Autism Helper Podcast. I am so excited to share this interview with you. Today, I am interviewing Alex Zakos, who is an SLP and the business owner of Meaningful Speech. And she is giving us kind of the 101 course on Gestalt Language Processing. Now, if you've heard of this, but aren't really sure exactly what it is, this episode is for you. Or even if this is something you're pretty familiar with, she gives so many great action tips. Gestalt language processing is really a different way to look at the way that language and communication develops. Alex will give a great overview of exactly what it is and the different stages. And when I learned about this a few years ago, it really kind of struck a nerve with me in a good way, because I kept thinking about students that I had previously kind of struggled with and been stuck. I didn't know what to do next. A lot of that echolalia and delayed echolalia, and we don't really have a plan. And Gestalt language processing really teaches that echolalia communicates. And through this framework, we can support our learners in developing meaningful communication. And that's exactly what Alex is going to talk about. As I said, if this is a brand new topic for you, stay tuned. If you are super familiar, she's still going to give a lot of great user-friendly tips, which is what I love. We talk about how to incorporate this into the classroom and what to do if you're like, oh my gosh, I want to learn more. She's got a lot of great tools on her website, Meaningful Speech, that we will link in the show notes. So let's go ahead and hear from Alex. Hi, Alex. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me today.
I am excited to have you on today because I've been wanting to do an episode on this topic for a while, because it's something, as I was sharing before, that's newer to me. And I feel like the more we learn about different strategies, the better teachers, parents, clinicians we are. So today we're going to talk about Gestalt language development. So you kind of want to give us kind of the elevator pitch. I know we'll go into more detail, but can you kind of give that brief overview of what that is?
Sure. So Gestalt language development is the quote unquote other way of developing language that a lot of us did not learn about in college or graduate school or even in life. What we see on TV and what we hear about is analytic language development, which is a child starts babbling and then they have first words and then they're having, you know, two word to three word combinations like mommy, mommy milk, and mommy get milk. And then by preschool years, they have mini conversations with us. So that's the language development that we're seeing in media and that we're kind of taught about and that we're expecting as parents and professionals. Gestalt language development doesn't start out that way. So Prezant and Rydell in the research call analytic language processors word babies, and they call Gestalt language processors intonation babies. So in Gestalt language development, there are six stages, and they were outlined by Dr. Barry Present in his 1983 publication, stages 1 to 4, and then my mentor, Marge Blanc, fleshed out stages 5 and 6 when she published her 2012 book, Natural Language Acquisition. And so I'll just give a brief overview of the stages, but stage 1 is when a child is very focused on intonation, so the sound stream of language. They are not really processing words as units yet. And stage 1 can look very different. A child can have one or all of these things, but they can have movie scripts or media scripts like To Infinity and Beyond. They might be communicating with those. We might hear large strings of unintelligible language that we can't quite make out. However, it has rich intonation. Again, that intonation piece. We might also hear a lot of what I call stuck single words in stage 1. So they're labeling, they have a lot of single words, but they're not going anywhere with those words. They're not being combined. They're not moving forward in that analytic language developmental process. So again, in stage 1, a child can have one or all of those things. And we call stage 1 delayed echolalia. And we say they're communicating with gestalts. And what a gestalt is an intonationally defined unit of meaning. It's very meaningful to the child. It's usually tied to an emotional or dramatic experience. And it can be very long or very short. It can be as long as a whole book or song, or it can be as short as one word like fish. And I use the fish example constantly because I had a client who went on a fishing trip with his dad, and he came away with the word fish, and it was tied to the meaningful experience of actually seeing the lake. And it wasn't necessarily about the actual fish. And so it encompassed this bigger, meaningful experience for him. So he would often communicate with it when he felt happy because he had this joyous experience with his father fishing. So therein lies another point I wanted to make. We cannot take gestalts literally. So, you know, fish doesn't mean fish for this kid because it's tied to that meaningful experience. In stage 2, a child starts to do a couple different things. They're either trimming down longer gestalts. So I had a client that said, "Don't worry, I'll help you find your mama," from Dora the Explorer. In stage 2, I started to hear, "Don't worry." So she trimmed it down. Or they start to mix and match. So I heard, "Don't worry, I'll help you find grandma," instead of "Don't worry, I'll help you find your mama." So she was able to kind of move and mix and match that gestalt around. Stage 3 is what I call the magic stage, and that is when a child begins processing words as units. So that light bulb goes off for them, and they realize, oh, I don't need this whole chunk, "Don't worry, I'll help you find your mama." I can actually pull down the word mama, and mama can stand alone. And to infinity and beyond, I might pull down beyond, and beyond can stand alone. And we call this freeing the words from their gestalts. And stage 3 can be single words, or it can be two word combinations like noun plus noun or adjective plus noun. Stage 4 is when they start self-generating language. So that is when we actually start hearing that novel language. And a lot of it is that beginning or quote-unquote bad grammar. So we might hear, "I fall down." Prior to stage 4, we're not worried at all about grammar. So in stage 4, we do start, you know, coming up with some grammar targets for the child. And stages 5 and 6 are a little bit more of this. 5 and 6 are considered advanced and complex grammar. So that is a very incredibly brief overview of the stages of gestalt language development, but you will see they are much different from the stages of analytic language development. And the last thing I want to point out before we move on to other questions is that language processing is a continuum. So I personally teach about kids that are toward the end of the continuum where they are fully Gestalt language processors, as my mentor Marge Blanc has said before using that word fully. There are kids that will fall in the middle of the continuum or toward the other end. We see the kids that are fully Gestalt language processors as usually needing speech and language support through the stages, usually, but not always. And we also know that most autistic individuals are Gestalt language processors. Maybe not all, but most of them. And this is based on some of the research from Dr. Barry Present.
Thank you so much. I can tell that you have done that elevator pitch often, and I loved it. So when you first started talking, especially about stage one and two, and I was thinking about the first time I really learned about this in detail, probably a year or two ago, as I said, the intonation thing really struck me, because I have so many former students and former clients, and one that I right away was like, oh my God, this kid, like, this is him. And I had him for 4 or 5 years when I was a teacher, and he was bilingual. He spoke mostly in Spanish, and my Spanish was not great at that time. Mm-hmm. But we could communicate purely based on his intonation of things he was repeating, on if it was like this happier, upbeat phrase. And it was a lot of telenovelas. And it was a lot of, like, you know, that, like, I knew what was happening in the telenovelas all the time, but based purely also on his intonation and how he was feeling. And I kind of felt pretty successful in communicating it with him and understanding how he felt that day based on his intonations. And it was that sing-songy, you know, kind of repertoire that we hear a lot. And I was like, oh gosh, I, you know, thinking back, like, wish I had more tools to support him, because as you kind of explained, that natural language development, that was so not him. Mm-hmm. And I knew that, but I didn't really have any tools to do anything else besides, like, all right, it seems like you're in a rough mood today, because based on the kind of scripts you're giving me right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I love that they were from telenovelas, because our GLPs are attracted to this dramatic emotional stuff. That's usually when language sticks, and we all know soap operas are very dramatic and emotional.
Yeah, I mean, they are. I mean, they had great storylines. What I could pick up too, I was like, oh man, that woman has two different boyfriends. Oh my gosh. But yeah, so it, you know, looking back, you know, if you're in this world, whether you're a teacher or clinician, you for sure are identifying connections there, especially I think in those first few stages of, like, oh my gosh, these are kids on my caseload. These are kids in my classroom right now.
One thing I did want to point out that I did not mention at all are our non-speaking or minimally speaking Gestalt language processors. So you can definitely be developing language this way and be non-speaking. And there are other signs to look for that. I think because this is so new to people, we're going to be kind of going over the basics today. But I will at the end list some of my resources where you could kind of look a little bit more into that population as well.
Yeah, that would be really helpful, because I also think, you know, as a special ed teacher, we hear a lot about echolalia, and we hear that, you know, is going to be part of our students' repertoire. But that's kind of, I think, where instruction, at least on a teacher standpoint, ends, of like, okay, this will be here. And you're like, cool, what does that mean? And they're like, that's it. Like, that's all we get, you know, right? As opposed to some kind of space to help us understand what that means for that child.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The crazy thing is, this research, this pioneering research, has been around since the 70s and 80s from Dr. Ann Peters, Dr. Barry Present and his team, and then kind of didn't resurface until 2012 when Marge Blanc published her natural language acquisition book. And then I took things to social media in very early January 2021, and just kind of started talking about what I had learned from Marge and her book. And I honestly think that things have gotten so large and everyone's talking about this now, because we are blown away, because we've seen these kids on our caseload and we didn't know what to do about them. And it's kind of upsetting that, hey, this research has been there this whole time. We could have known what to do.
yeah and you're right that they're kids that, you know, I always taught junior high. So it was kids that were 10 to 14, meaning they've been in school, you know, 10 years, and were kind of stay at the same spot we were when we entered preschool. So yeah. At that point, you know, I'm always like, well, if something's not working, we got to pivot, but we didn't have a plan to pivot to.
Exactly. And then I feel like so many clinicians get into this whole, well, they've plateaued, they can't make any more progress. But that's because we were looking at them through a disordered analytic language processor lens. Like, oh, you're not developing language like these other kids. You must have a disorder and now you've plateaued and can't go further. Mm-hmm. But when we actually do pivot and look at them like gestalt language processors, we realize, well, there has not been a plateau. We just haven't been looking at their language development correctly.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 6-packs of Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get juicy red, green, or black seedless grapes for 99 cents a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Do you think people maybe get, I don't know, confused isn't the right word, but yeah, maybe confused looking at through between these lenses, because sometimes students that maybe are really a gestalt language processor have some like baby steps or little victories that it are more in line with that natural language development. But so people are like, oh, wow, they've made, you know, requested cookie with cookie, but like then we're stuck at cookie for 2 years. Like, right. And then we aren't making other progress. Do you think then people are like, oh, well, which one is it kind of thing?
Absolutely. This comes up time and time again. I'm really glad that you brought this up. And what I have recently been trying to talk more about is some of our traditional or compliance-based approaches will give us short-term gains because these kids are amazing at memorizing. Mm-hmm. And so those short-term gains, might be a lot of single words, or they might be some survival language, but then we do get to a point where things don't move further. And so I talk about, do we want short-term gains or long-term gains? And this is, we're kind of playing the long game by really, truly taking a deep look at their language development and realizing that some of the strategies that we were trying to use before that seemed to be working truly aren't. It's just giving them more memorized or taught language.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And because I for sure can think of kids and clients that, you know, we've got 4 or 5 kind of really basic, super like high preferred item requests and that's it. And it's like, well, okay, we got that, but like what else? And then we're seemingly stuck there.
Exactly. And then I think with some of our older kids, I had a consultation this morning about a 14-year-old. What we're seeing is they have a lot of what we call scattered skills. So maybe he can answer some questions, but the majority of the day he's communicating with gestalts. And staff is frustrated because they're saying, well, but yesterday he answered these questions. And so they keep writing WH question goals for him. But when you look at things through the gestalt language developmental lens, you're going, okay, well, yeah, maybe there's a little bit of language in stage 4. Maybe there's a little bit of language in stage 2, but he's living in stage 1. He's spending the majority of his day there. That's where we need to support him.
Okay, that's kind of interesting too, to think of the stages not necessarily as so linear, but
they're not kind of linear, right? Mm-hmm.
So thinking about, all right, we have kids, clients, whatever, students in this group. What does the difference in language support look like from the adult perspective?
Yes,
as opposed to that traditional kind of approach.
Yes, thanks for bringing that up because that is the most important piece. So before we really switch our approach with the kid, I always say the change starts with you, the communication partner, and we're not going to try to change anything with the child. We're going to try to change ourselves. And so a lot of what happens when we're using a traditional approach is we're looking at strategies or techniques like we want to increase vocabulary. We want more labeling. We want them to answer questions. We want them to expand utterances. And that doesn't really work for our early stage gestalt language processors because if you remember, like they don't process words as units till stage 3. So in stages one and two, what we want to be doing is using natural language and using declarative language. So we want to lay off the questions. We want to focus on narrating and commenting. We want to practice more silence so we can hear their spontaneous language emerge. And we want to acknowledge all of their communication, because too often in the past, people have tried to extinguish echolalia. They want to get rid of it. They want to make it go away. And what I see happening with a lot of kids is things like selective mutism or whisper scripting, where they still want to do it or say it. So they're doing it under their breath because otherwise it's not well accepted. And so by doing that, we're actually decreasing their communication. When we look at it as meaningful and we change the way we're communicating with them as communication partners, we're building rapport and connection and trust. And that's the foundation for all the steps that we're going to do after that. So, like, to get you started, if I see that a kid is mainly living in stage one, my goal is to look at like a communication inventory, look at all the communication functions and say, okay, do they have anything to communicate transitions, shared joy, help, self-advocacy, protest, not an exhaustive list, but just some examples here. And if not, I want to start naturally infusing some potential gestalts or offering some language in those categories through child-led play. And we can talk a little bit more about child-led play, but my goal is to give the child more language that is useful to them in their life. But I'm not forcing it. I'm not forcing compliance. I am offering it to them, because a gestalt language processor will pick up language that is meaningful to them. And otherwise they won't. Like, if it's not something that resonates with them, they're not going to pick it up. That's why so many media scripts get picked up by our gestalt language processors, because they're highly exciting and dramatic, and it's language that they want to pick up.
When you look at modeling those new, like, gestalt phrases that could have meaning for them, do you look at things that are already in their repertoire that they're already talking about, or is this like adding in something new here?
So it can be a little bit of both. So I talk about like a three-step process, where the first step is acknowledging their communication. So I'm repeating back what they say. I'm smiling. I'm nodding. I'm letting them know they've been heard. And the second step is what I call doing the detective work or the investigative work. So I'm trying to figure out what they mean by what they're communicating. So this boy that I consulted on earlier today, he says to staff, look at me or listen to me. And they're taking that literally. So they're saying, well, I am looking at you or I am listening to you. But what I explained is it's language that he picked up from someone somewhere at some point in time. And it doesn't actually mean look at me or listen to me. We have to kind of investigate what that means for him. And I actually don't know what that answer is right now. It's a question that I posed to the staff today, but I'm just going to, you know, make it up and say I did the investigative or detective work and I talked to his mom and I figured out that what that language means for him is like, I'm done with this, or I don't want to do this anymore. So then my third step, if I really know what it means for him, is I'm going to model some natural language that he can maybe accept if he wants to, that matches that situation. Because look at me and listen to me isn't serving him well. I don't want to extinguish it, but I'm going to offer him something else in that situation. So I might say, let's get out of here, or I'm done with this. Mm-hmm. And if a kid really resonates with what you're offering, you will see natural eye contact, unforced. They will naturally give you that eye contact. They will smile. They will nod. They will maybe immediately echo back what you've said. I've heard yeah from kids before, like, oh, yeah, you got me. laughing or giggling, like, ah, I can't believe you figured it out. Yep, that's what I wanted to say.
That makes sense. And you can see, probably, I would assume a lot of kids at this point are pretty frustrated too, because it's like they're speaking another language and no one's understanding them.
Absolutely. And depending on what kind of schooling or programming they've been in, they maybe have had many, many years of not really being understood, which brings me back to the foundational stuff I was talking about. So before we launch into what we're going to do with the communication, we need to realize that some unlearning needs to happen. And so we need to kind of build that foundation and trust with them. And a lot of that happens through this child-led play that I alluded to earlier. And when I say play, this can be for any age. So I'm not just talking about, you know, playing Barbies with a four-year-old. It can be playing basketball or cooking with a 16-year-old, whatever this child likes to do. It's child-led. So they are the ones dictating what's happening in the session or at home during, you know, a special time of day. They are not being adult-led. So too often, I think as speech and language therapists, as professionals, we go in there with some master plan and the kid has to sit down and do whatever laminated activity we printed. But that is not child-led, that's adult-directed. And we're only going to get a certain amount of language in that type of activity or a certain type of language. We're going to get the most spontaneous language from them when we are interacting in something that they have chosen.
I feel like that's really hard for adults. And I'm like saying adults, but I mean me. Like as a parent, it's hard for me. Like I'm getting better, but like what you said, like maybe 5-10 minutes ago, I realized a while ago is my downfall is I ask too many questions. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I do this as a clinician, as a teacher, I do this as a parent. I have to like really catch myself because I've seen quite like very obvious, it's aversive. Like it is just aversive to ask that many questions. And you can, I totally understand why. If a child is struggling to communicate and we're doing something they want to do, and then I'm like, let me ask you 16 questions about this. They're like, oh, lady, get away from me. Mm-hmm. Like, I've ruined it. I've made the fun thing not fun.
Exactly. And the other thing that's happening there is we're not building trust. We're like, hey, you can do whatever you want for a little bit, but then I'm going to come in here and sabotage it.
Yep.
And what you're doing is something we all struggle with. I mean, that was the hardest thing for me when I discovered all of this and switched approaches because it just wasn't how I was trained. And I'm hearing that from a lot of professionals now that are learning about this and trying to change things. Like it resonates with them. They intuitively know, okay, this is the direction I need to go in, but it's so hard for them to do it. So one of my tips actually is if you can stand it to videotape yourself. And then it's almost like you're coaching yourself. You go back and watch it like, okay, what could I have done here instead of asking this question? And one of the activities that we've done in our live training is we have a bunch of questions and then you have to turn them into declarative language. So if a kid's drawing, a lot of times as parents or professionals, we're saying like, oh, what did you draw? Oh, tell me about that. So instead, we might just make a comment and say, wow, that's big. And mm-hmm. then a little silence and see, you know, what's the child going to say? How are they going to respond?
I mean, I think that strategy is helpful even beyond what we're talking about today. Like I think about as a parent, I have three kids that mm-hmm. are natural language developers, like what you're talking about before. Mm-hmm. And you get so much more by doing something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like, ooh, like you threw your backpack on the ground when you came in. Like, and then they're like, yeah, well, I had a really bad day. This happened versus me being like, oh, why are you doing that? Did you have a bad day? Like what's going on? And mm-hmm. It's just even beyond this topic is a better way to get conversation and language and communication.
I completely agree. I have two kids of my own and now we're getting into the teenage years. And so I want to open that door and say, why are all these clothes on the floor? But, you know, it's better to just be like, oh, I see your volleyball uniform is on the floor. What are you gonna say?
Yeah. And I think, you know, even the traditional, like beyond autism and SLPs and all that, it just as a teacher, like you're like, well, I am the teacher. This is my job. They should be doing what I want. And that's a weird dichotomy, I think, for anything child-led to be there. So can you talk a little bit how you can see this being incorporated into a classroom setting successfully?
Yes. So I think we just talked about how we are as parents and professionals in our own disciplines, but I think teachers struggle very much to get out of Q&A mode. And I don't expect teachers to go in there and do language support with a Gestalt language processor. But the tips I just shared is what I want to see happening in the classroom. So just the basic foundational stuff. So I think too often I'm hearing from educators, they want to extinguish it. Why is he shouting this out? Make him stop. Instead of looking at the bigger picture of like, is there dysregulation here? Like I would love to train educators to put on their detective hats a little bit more. And it doesn't mean more work on their end, but like maybe just getting support from the right kind of professionals. Like maybe the OT needs to come in and take a look, because I always say echolalia communicates, but it might not always be communicating to us as the conversation partner or communication partner. It might be communicating, I don't feel good in my body right now. Or I don't know what to do in this situation. It's always communicating something. So we have the kids that are, you know, shouting out gestalts during class. And I would like the educator to just respond to that. Just be like, oh, okay, I hear you. And then maybe like, here, want to try a squishy ball? Or there's a band at the bottom of your chair, kind of help them, you know, start to learn the tools that they need to self-advocate when they're feeling a certain way. I think educators just don't know what to do right now. And so they go into that parent mode that we're talking about, and they're just like, what's wrong? Why are you shouting? You need to stop shouting. I'm teaching math.
And it's, I mean, my gosh, like the world of education has changed so much even in the last 5 years on class sizes and staffing and all this. So, I mean, teachers are stretched so thin. So you get the natural inclination to be like, I just need this to stop. Yes. But it's going to potentially make it worse too by approaching it that way.
Yes. And I see it just all as like band-aids. If we're not dealing with like the root cause of something, it's going to keep resurfacing.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
I feel like I've been talking so much. So.
No. I was going to take it in a little bit of a different direction. But so like advice for a teacher. So let's say a teacher is listening and they're like, oh my gosh, my kids need this. This is like, you know, where we're at. Like, but let's say their SLP does not do things this way. Yeah. They don't have a ton of support. Like their OT is not super available. Like as you were mentioning, like let's get the OT in. I think so often to like kids being dismissed from OT in schools because they're meeting their school needs, quote unquote.
Right.
You know, and you're like, oh God, it's not just handwriting. But you know, a teacher in that position, which many are, what are the steps they can take to, I guess, to not do damage, to keep that relationship and rapport and start to make some positive steps forward with this?
Yeah, I think the three steps I shared earlier, which is one is acknowledge all communication. So just rid themselves of the notion that they want it to go away. And so we're acknowledging it. We can teach other students in the class to acknowledge it as well. Like this is how he communicates. We're going to acknowledge it. He's communicating something right now. And then two, we're going to try to do the investigative or detective work. Okay, maybe you can't get the OT or the SLP in there. Well, bring it up at the team meeting or the IEP meeting. Like, does anyone know what this means? Maybe bring it up to the parents at parent-teacher conferences if you can, or if there's a way to communicate with the family. I know it's harder at school. And then the third thing is, if you do know, you know, what that means, you can model language that might fit the situation for the child, or just you could take a shot in the dark and just model some language that matches that situation, even if you can't do that detective work, and just offer it to them. So it might look something like Timmy is shouting out like, help, help, help in the classroom. And maybe that came from a Disney flick, and maybe it doesn't actually mean that he needs help. It might not, because most gestalts are not literal. Unless, of course, he's been taught to say that. And that's a whole mm-hmm. topic for another podcast where we can get into taught language versus natural language. I do have a blog post on that that we can link below if people want to check out. But let's just say he's screaming, help, 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 help. The teacher is going to acknowledge it, even if it's disrupting her math lesson. Like, oh, hey, Timmy. Yeah, I hear you. And then if she's like, I don't know if he needs help. I don't know why he's shouting right now. I don't know what's going on. I can model language that's more natural to the context. Like, I'm going to work on math right now. Like, I'm going to come and talk to you later. So I like to model from I and I'm and we and avoid that you in the early stages, because a kid will echo back the language that they are given. They will take whatever language they're given. So a lot of people think that's pronoun reversal, but it isn't. They're just repeating the language of the original speaker. So if I say, go get your shoes, it might become a gestalt for the child. And they say to me, go get your shoes, but they actually mean they're putting on their own shoes.
Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense.
We avoid those pronouns a little bit in the early stages until later when we start targeting grammar.
I had a student that put the word awesome at the end of every phrase, and I realized it's because I said it. Like, I'd be like, let's get on our shoes. And then they would say, I was like, and I'd be like, awesome. And then, so then he put awesome at the end of every sentence. And I was like, who says that? My friends were like, you do. And I was like, oh God. Yep. So yeah, be thinking about what you're saying.
Sounds like a GLP right there.
Yeah, for sure. And kind of same question, but looking at this child-led piece. So I think that's something that I've kind of struggled with and struggled to teach about, because I, you know, learning about like Early Start Denver model, things like that, they're like, oh my gosh, this could be so powerful for so many of our kids. And we see the value, you know, whatever perspective you're even taking, you see the value in like letting kids do what they want, like from, you know, a reinforcer standpoint, preferred standpoint, language standpoint. But how do we balance that in a classroom where you can't, you know, teacher's like, well, they can't be child-led from 8:30 to 3:30. And I get that. Mm-hmm. How can you incorporate that piece into the classroom schedule and environment?
So, well, a couple of things here. I think that school is a certain way and our special ed programs are a certain way, because in the past, our goal was to get our kids to look neurotypical. That was our goal. That's the medical model of disability. But now with the neurodiversity affirming movement, we are looking at things a little bit differently. And it's like, we are not trying to get autistic kids to look like neurotypical kids. We want them to embrace their autism. And that's where child-led comes in, right? So my goal is not, you are going to play with toys the way Bobby is playing with toys. My motto is like, all play is okay. So the way that we can bring that into the classroom is child-led play is not a free-for-all. So it's not like, oh, you're just playing and roaming around the room all day. But it's like, are we offering choices that are going to make the child feel good? And you know what? A traditional classroom might not make certain autistic kids feel good anyway. It just might be very dysregulating to them. But like, can it be child-led and they are laying on their stomachs on the ground writing, or they're on a bouncy ball, or they have some different seating? Are we looking at play-based preschool and kindergarten, or are they sitting like they're in third grade at the early age of five? We need to totally
Get me started on kindergarten.
Yes, we need to reevaluate early childhood and kindergarten programs, and those can be incredibly child-led, okay? But right now, a large majority are not, and they honestly look like what third grade looked like in the 80s.
Yep. I mean, the standards are insane for kindergarten. Like, I can't. It's another topic.
It is. It's a whole other podcast.
And poor teachers, you know, I mean, it's like, I mean, they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? Because they have these like standards that you have to hit. And they're like, cool, but these kids are five. Like, right. You know, they don't know or want to sit in a chair yet. And that's okay, because they're five. But digress. Okay, those are great tips. And I like that, you know, thinking about, okay, well, where can we give autonomy and how can we let them be their authentic self and not always looking to like, okay, the goal is compliance. The goal is just engagement and learning and thinking kind of critically about the goals that we're setting.
Right. Absolutely.
All right. Love this. I feel like I could talk about this forever, but I will. I don't want to go too many directions. We'll have to have an episode too. So if people want to learn more, where do you recommend they start, especially for someone that's beginner to this?
Yes. So earlier this year, I released a free 54-minute masterclass on echolalia and child-led therapy. Almost 25,000 people have watched, which makes me really happy. So that is a starting point. You can get that right on my homepage. You can go to meaningfulspeech.com. We also have a free handout on there where you get on our email list, and it's perfect to share with caregivers, schools, staff, anyone that you kind of want to say, hey, this is how my child is learning language. So that is a starting point for people. And then if they want to dive deeper, we do offer pretty deep courses in Gestalt Language Development and then Gestalt Language Development in AAC, which is probably a whole nother podcast topic as well. But you can find all that at meaningfulspeech.com, and we post a lot of free information on our social media account, and we do a weekly blog post. And on social media, you can find us at Meaningful Speech.
Great. I will link all of that and specifically the link for the masterclass as well. Well, thank you so much, Alex. I hope everyone goes to learn more about this, and I think kind of have maybe a light bulb moment and thinking differently about, you know, some of their students or caseload. So thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Autism Helper podcast. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, hit subscribe. It would mean a lot to me if you left some feedback. Whether I'm working one-on-one with a student, doing a podcast like this one, or presenting for a PD, my goal is always to provide as much value as I can. So your feedback really helps me make sure I'm doing just that. If you have other topics you'd like me to cover, leave in the feedback or message me on social media. You can follow me at The Autism Helper on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Pinterest, or visit my website, theautismhelper.com. Thanks again for listening.
Got questions? O'Reilly Auto Parts has answers. Need a pro you can trust? We've got that too. No matter what you need, our professional parts people have the training and expertise to help you do things right. Deep automotive knowledge. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Having the right resources for your classroom is essential to making sure your classroom is running smoothly. At the Autism Helper Shop, we have all of the resources you need to make sure you have the behavior, communication, and curriculum supports for your students. Within our shop, we have adapted books, task cards, resources aligned to the VBMAP and the ABLES, behavior plan flowcharts, data sheets, curriculum. Everything you need, whether you are an early childhood teacher or a high school teacher, we have all of the resources that will meet those students' needs. So head over to shop.theautismhelper.com to check out all of our resources.